Finally, this hour, maybe once in a while, we all get a chance to thank someone who influenced our lives as a kid, maybe a teacher or a coach. But what about someone you never met who was there for you, but they don't even know it? Our producer, John Asante, had the chance to connect with such a person in his life who showed up on a book tour. This goes way beyond a fan moment.
For me, it was a DJ, or a VJ in this case. I was about 12 years old, and Dave Holmes was the guy on MTV who'd fed my obsession for new music, and who made me feel cool. He introduced me to some big pop hits and even some deep cuts. And so when I got a chance to talk with him, it turns out we both used our love of music as a way to fit in.
Music has always been playing in my life. I grew up Irish Catholic. My family is very much into music in kind of a more sensible way than I was. And also it was because my brothers were so much older than I was. It seemed like the only way, like the first way that I was able to fit in with my family was just by singing along with the radio. Music is love, really, for me. For some people, it's smell. For some people, it's sight. For me, it's a song. Like, if I hear a song that I haven't heard in 30 years, I remember everything about 1986.
With your family, what song or songs were the family songs that you guys would all sing together?
Oh, my first memory is early Wings, Jet, and Silly Love Songs.
Paul McCartney.
Yeah. It was just the fact that everybody knew every word and everyone was singing along, and it was like a communal experience.
I mean, this is the time where Casey Kasem is just like...
Casey Kasem.
Yeah. Big, right.
Casey Kasem was a towering figure in my life because he took pop music seriously.
I'm Casey Kasem, and at number one last week on American Top 40 was this smash.
He would put effort into people's stories, and like he would read those long distance dedications with such emotion, you know, and he knew that like certain people have to hear this song. It's going to bring them back together. It might make that runaway girl come back home or whatever. He would do American Top 40, and at the end he would read off that list of names of producers and whatnot. And like for a kid in the Midwest who saw no way forward for himself, to think like maybe someday I'll be on a team like that. Like our life will be music.
And it seems like you found that first team when you were at Priory.
Catholic school. I went to an all-boys Catholic school, very conservative, and very in the manner of boys' schools, very fearful. There were like 40-something of us in a class, and you just didn't want to stand out. You wanted to be normal like everybody else. There was a small handful of us who were as into music video and music as I was. And we would find our little corner, and we would put in our little cassettes into our little boombox, and you know, listen to Pat Benatar and discuss it and get into it.
And this is at the point where you're also thinking more and more about your sexuality and what it means to who you were. That was something that you were battling. And what were, I guess, some of the songs that you really identified with in terms of like not being able to express yourself the way you wanted to?
You know, one thing that I remember really vividly was when Purple Rain came out.
Yeah.
Because that was just, that transcended. It didn't matter what kind of kid you were. You loved Purple Rain. And I remember I had a sleepover. A couple of my friends from school came over, and it was the summer between 7th and 8th grade. It was the summer of 1984, which is a stellar summer for music. And we all three bought our individual copies of Purple Rain on vinyl. And then we went back to my house to listen to it. And one of my friends had like a bowl cut. And the other two of us were like, we were in more of like a hair styled moment. And I had some mousse. And I remember talking to Derek and looking at John with his bowl cut and just saying like, we're going to fix that. And just attacking him with mousse and giving him a more stylish look, which like, as I was doing it, I was like, this is not what a normal boy does. But Prince was playing, and Prince was in lingerie, and Prince was the biggest thing in the world. And it was like, I don't care what a normal boy does. For the moment, I'm like, Prince is on the stereo and I'm free. And right. I'm gonna style my friend's hair. And he thanked me for it.
I found it really interesting how you also explained how you chose to go from your private Catholic school to a private Catholic college.
Yeah.
Holy Cross.
Yeah. Out of the frying pan into the deeply repressed fire.
Yeah.
I think at the time I was really caught up with the idea of being good. Like I still felt like who I was starting to learn that I was not right. And I needed to learn to go somewhere and just tamp it all down and be normal. Just learn by exposure how to be normal, how to just be what I thought my parents wanted me to be. You know, you get really, when you grow up gay, you get told a lot of lies about yourself. You get told that if you live your life the way you want to live your life, that there is no option for you to be good or to be virtuous or to have your family be proud of you or whatever. And I was still very hypnotized by that idea. So I think, you know, where I should have maybe gone to some place where I could have let the artsy and not straight side of myself flourish a little bit, at the last minute I was like, nope, I'm going to go put on some J. Crew clothes like normal people, and I'm just going to be normal.
Then there was this turning point. Okay, I need to figure out who I am. I want to be comfortable with being gay. And the way you went about telling people.
Yeah. So I wrote an anonymous letter to the school newspaper about my experience being like a gay person on campus. And it's like, reading it now, it is so overwrought and so like full of conflicted, self-loathing Catholic 19-year-oldness. But I'm glad that I did it, because it did start a conversation. People did, you know, start to wonder whether there might be an actual homosexual in their midst. And they started to talk about it a little bit.
And then comes New York City, which,
yeah,
it seems like it took a little while to get, like, find your footing. Like,
oh, sure.
Yeah.
I think at the time, like, I felt like the only place to meet people was in bars. And the only place where there were bars was Chelsea. And everybody looked exactly the same. It was like an army of clones, like I'd never seen before. And I didn't quite fit in. But I'm glad I didn't fit in.
I will say, the one place where before you, I guess, maybe went on that path was to try out to be a VJ.
That's true.
The wannabe VJ contest, which...
That's true. Yeah. It was a really crazy thing to have done. As I was, you know, wasting time at my job checking Billboard to see who was, you know, who was in the charts, there was a story that MTV was doing an open call for VJs. And I was like, well, okay, I'm going to circle that date on my calendar and I'm going to call in sick and I'm going to go. And I did, and it ended up being a thing that I didn't get the job, but I stuck around and I pushed and I was persistent. I was, you know, as stalkerish as I have ever been, and I pushed until I got myself a writing job, and then after a fashion I got put on the air. Like, it literally fundamentally altered the course of my life, and I almost blew it off to like sleep for 90 more minutes and then go to my job.
Right.
That's crazy.
And so between like hosting shows like Say What Karaoke,
yeah,
and then like getting it on TRL, and you write about like the music videos that really, you know, really defined your time there and what,
yeah,
made it for you. Like, what, I guess, what still stands out to you, like, in terms of artists and music? And...
I mean, all of that boy band stuff, all of the Backstreet Boys and NSYNC and Britney Spears and Christina Aguilera. I mean, that really, that is a golden age of pop music. I don't care. And those songs really stand up. To know that I was like, in some small part, I was there for somebody's like huge pop music awakening is so exciting. And to watch kids come into the studio or like hold signs out in Times Square, just to see the pure joy in their face, just to be near MTV was like you couldn't help but feel grateful and happy every single day.
There's Dave Holmes, the VJ, and that everybody's, you know, grown to love and everything.
Oh, that's very sweet.
I know there were other comments that people had.
I personally, there were detractors, but yeah.
I personally remember watching and being like, oh yeah, there's Dave.
Thanks.
You know, tell me about the countdowns and everything.
Thank
and,
you.
Know, and all the good music.
Aww.
And then there's, as I'm reading, there's a Dave Holmes that like we get to know through the book as this person who's trying to fit in, but now also trying to like now embracing his differentness.
Yeah, yeah.
And it seems like there's a point where those two points like converge, but you decide to, you know, come out publicly, not
right
on MTV though.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there was kind of no way. I mean, there was no social media back then. There was no Twitter.
Right.
The only way that like you could talk to viewers or people who liked you or whatever was at your job or like through the media or whatever. And so I just never could quite figure out how to come out, because there was never like a graceful way to say I'm gay on the air. It never seemed to be like pertinent to what was going on. We talked about doing like a National Coming Out Day special, but then I was like, do I want my coming out to be like a variety show? Like, is that a thing to do? And so I didn't. And I eventually did an interview with Out Magazine. And it was, you know, kind of a non-event because, you know, well, who cares ultimately?
Yeah.
I mean, it is me after all. You know what I mean? Like, it's not that big a deal. But it did feel nice. It did feel nice. And I have to like hope that it resonated in some way for some kid who is 13 who watched me or who knows me or whatever. Like, I grew up without any clear like gay adult role models. So the idea of just like being somebody who people might know who is out was very exciting to me.
What do you choose to listen to these days?
Ooh, there's so much coming at you from so many different venues that it's like it's almost impossible to keep up. There is no single culture anymore. There's no monoculture anymore. I don't know how kids do it. I don't know how kids grow up. Like, because I mean, as you have read, I mark my time like through the songs and the movies and whatever of my youth. I don't know if you can do that anymore. I'm really into the Hold Steady. They're a band that reminds me so much of what I loved growing up. They're very influenced by the Replacements, but they're also men my age, you know, who are telling stories of men my age, but it doesn't feel like sad old guy music. It doesn't feel like something you would buy in a Starbucks or whatever. It's real and it's like vital and energetic. There is music being made by people my age that really feels like the freshest and most interesting thing there. I never would have imagined that happening.
Devil and Sean Berryman, they took a walk together and they ended up on Washington talking to the river.
That was Takeaway producer John Asante talking with Dave Holmes, a former MTV VJ and currently an on-air personality on Sirius XM's The Spectrum. He's the author of Party of One, a memoir in 21 songs. Out this week.
She said you're pretty good with words, but words won't save your life, and they didn't, so he died.